Dumelang Thobela, hello and welcome to this week's news wrap-up brought to you by the SL Cabinet. I am your host today, Gwena Mashale, joined by my colleague, Nandi Ntini.
Hi everyone.
So we are the youth of today, bringing you all things new and current affairs through our eyes. I hope you stick with us as we look at the week's biggest stories, talk about the controversies and laugh about the weird ones. Let's get comfortable and let's dive right in. So obviously, this week's first topic that I wanted to just jump onto was NASFAS. NASFAS has been trending since Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And I think we all know why. You know, NASFAS is always making the rounds on social media, and it's because of funding. So there seemed to be a problem with landlords were evicting students at the Urban Circle in Ellis Park this week. And it was a matter because obviously what? They weren't getting their money from NASFAS. And apparently these landlords say they have not been getting funds for at least half of the year now, since February. And the students were like, no, but it's not really our fault. You need to speak to NASFAS about the problem because they also haven't received the allowance. So Gatle, what's going on with NASFAS, you know, Nandi?
Well, I feel like NASFAS keeps on having the same problem over and over again. It's not the first time where they were unable to pay for accommodation and tuition. Because I remember with my case when I first went to varsity in 2017. So they said I was funded and then defunded right before, I think it was in March. So I went through the first semester, the first 6 months without not being funded. So I had to travel and then... Finally, I don't know what happened or who did what, because I never even did an appeal, because I was like, you know what, I'll see what's going to happen. And then they started funding me, and then all the money that came in from the in February, and then that's where they compensated and paid for my tuition and also for my accommodation. But I also feel like with these students, I don't think that's the case now.
I mean, I think I think some of them, it's a matter that I think... NASFAS, because it's having the problems with service providers, right? So they're going back and forth with service providers. And I remember in last week, actually, Friday, where they lost a case at the Western Cape High Court against Izaga. So Izaga took them to court because it was a matter of they had to terminate their contract because of the Vaxman report. I hope I'm saying that right. So essentially, the Vaxman report is about how it was investigating the allegations of how the service providers got their money, got the contract and there was a problem with the CEO, right? And basically there was just a lot of conflict of interest, and so the Vaxman report was like, you know what, just in general, our recommendation is to just actually cut these contractors off. But Izaga was like, no, but that's not fair because you gave us a year full year contract. But so obviously they took them to court, and it was a matter of the court actually sided with Izaga, and obviously the other service providers are inputted on that. But now NASFAS is like, yeah, but the Vaxman report says we need to cut you guys off. And we are going to cut you guys off, especially considering the fact that you guys are always having problems with the students. So now NASFAS says we're going to directly pay them. But here's the bat problem. NASFAS's system, registration system, is completely not up to date. So it's forever either defunding students for the wrong reasons, exactly, or it's either confusing students with students who have been getting money and those who have not been getting money. And it's constantly saying, no, universities need to update their information so that we don't double pay students, so that we don't have the same case. Who's the girl who received 14 million?
But they should not blame that girl. They should not blame the system of the universities. They know what they are doing from the inside.
And my thing is also, why do we always constantly have to have the same problems? It's like they're not learning. I would think that they would learn from their systems and learn from the dysfunctions, but it's the same problem all the time. And these children, these students are left, you know, vulnerable.
I don't think they really assess for the children that cannot afford to pay their own tuition. And then here I am, I'm relaxed. I know that you're taking care of my fundings and all of that. And now you're telling me that, no, I'm getting evicted. This is, and then now I have to still look concentrate on my exams and schoolwork. It's not going to happen, and it's not fair on students.
It's definitely not fair, even on the parents, especially because I know that I was talking to this one woman. She, her child goes to UFS, and she was basically explaining how it's a struggle to now constantly have to hear your child complaining. Wana sometimes will even think about suicidal thoughts because she's being, not only is she told that she can't be funded, but she can't go to school. She was guaranteed she would go to school, but now she can't go to school. And she doesn't have the money to send her child to school. So I was at the Central Johannes CJC in Ellis Park, where I spoke to one of the students. And we can get a listen from one of the students now.
My name is Mfundi Mkanyana, and I'm a CJC student in Ellis Park. So now we like having a problem areas where we stay in the research, it's Eben Circle, like we cannot. Where is Olo, by Elevas Kiel.
And how long did they lock you guys out?
It was from 11 straight to Buyeskela up until half past five.
And what happened at half past five for them to let you guys back in?
They told us, Uguti, they spoke to the SRC Eskolweni, where they have the agreement, Uguti, they can now put us in. But in conditions, though, but once you enter in,
so it's a very difficult situation to be in. And then you remember, then you have conversations like the DA saying no, they want to scrap NSFAS entirely and create student loans. I think
like those are I'm not gonna lie, DA is just on another level. That it does not make sense. I can't go to varsity for 3 years. We have graduates that can't find jobs. Now I have to tell us about not finding a job, and then I have to pay the loan.
Loans back.
No, they must take a job.
I mean, you
pill.
Still have those the guys who obviously before NSFAS decided to actually turn NSFAS into an actual bursary. We still have those ones who, some of them are still repaying their loans. We don't know. Some of them are still being deducted in terms of their pay slip. It's just that one that's constantly minusing, and you're like, what is this one? And it's just NSFAS getting back their money. So now you imagine having that, and you go to work, and you're on your first paycheck, it just distracts.
Imagine.
Because it's a student loan. You said you wanted money to study, we gave you, but it's a loan. And I think that mentality is also like kind of like, you know, Nelson Mandela, I mean, happy birthday to Nelson Mandela, by the way. Nelson Mandela was like free education to all, but now you're making me pay for education. No. It doesn't make sense. But then again, you know, speaking of education, you know what's funny? I kind of, when we talk about education, we sometimes also forget that there's also the kids, right? The basic education kids. And my gosh, guys, I'm not sure if you guys heard about the car crash, the one that killed the 11 children. Yes, same, hey?
Yeah, it's very sad. And when I saw that 4 kids from one home, that really broke my heart.
Oh, dude.
Because it means the future of that family is doomed, because they were obviously looking up to the education and for them making it in life. And now the bike driver decided, no, man, I'm going to cut their lives short.
We don't exactly know what happened, and you making it seem as if the guy deliberately
I'm sorry, but I saw the bike, because the thing is, I saw how the bike looked, and then I saw the taxi, it actually burned.
But then again, you know what, in those situations, we can try to pinpoint who was in the wrong and who was in the wrong, but we don't exactly know what happened. And I'm honestly, I've yet to hear the bike actually explain to us whether he was on his phone, what happened, did he miss a red light, and everything like that. But my other problem is that it wouldn't have been a big casualty like that if the guy didn't overpack the text.
Yes, also
that's the problem that we have in South Africa, that we've gotten to a point where we normalize the overloading in the taxis. And again, we don't blame the taxi driver. We don't blame him. We don't, you know, but at the same time, it would have saved a lot. You know, there's a lot of would haves. What if, what if not, you know? But in this situation, 11 kids is a lot.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And all of them to completely go and completely die. I mean, there was this one mother that says that one of her children tried to actually save the younger sibling from the fire, but she was stopped by the teachers because it was just so bad. And so she actually had to, the sibling had to watch her younger sibling die.
That was torture.
Real
trauma.
Dude, it's traumatic on another level. So at our photographer, one of the Uthulani, was the one who was on the story in regards to the car crash. And he spoke to one of the women, the mothers there at the school. And this is what she had to say.
Yo, little one was Dotu. He was bubbly, full of jokes. Every situation, he would laugh. And it was irritating, but I remember at the age of 5 years, he started stuttering and I got quiet. We couldn't understand why, because all this is not right, but then we got used to it. So, he was in a little sweetheart. Oh, I lost an angel. He was 9 years.
It's so sad because they felt it.
Exactly. And the driver, apparently, the taxi driver was already dead on impact. He was already dead. So some of the kids were still alive outside, but the taxi driver was already dead on impact. And it's such a thing that also brings into the question of road etiquette.
Hmm.
What are we doing on the roads, guys? Are we texting and driving while we're driving? What are we doing? Our editor was talking on Monday, this Monday, and she was just speaking about how most we've gotten careless in a sense that we are genuinely always on our phones on the road. Mm. And you could get into an accident, a simple accident, just because you're on the phone and you don't realize it. And it's road etiquette, guys. I think, let me just put the road etiquette.
It's very important. And it's very sad because, you know, a taxi, it's like 16 of us and you are in your private car. It's only one of you.
Exactly.
And then the lives of the people that you're costing are more than your own. So it's something that we really need to start focusing on as South Africans. We can't say, my life is always like, my whole life is on the phone, but also consider that other people's lives are more important than what you're doing in your phone.
Mm. I mean, you have the campaign study, Arrive Alive, you know. That are constantly advocating for you to be safe on the road, to not text and drive. I think that is the basic 101 in terms of driving. Do not text and drive. But there's always something urgent that we constantly need to do on our phones that you don't even realize that you're actually endangering other
people. But is it that urgent?
That's the question. Speaking of students, you know, pupils.
Yes.
Let me correct myself. Pupils. So you have pupils in Northwest, right? Mm. I must say this was very interesting when we saw it. Pupils were searched, and it was a raiding by the police, and apparently they did this raiding because the school is such a, how can I call it, a hot spot for gangsterism, that to a point where when they were raiding these students and these pupils, they found pangas, they found knives, they found toy guns. There was just a stash of weapons on the premises. And it was really, really bewildering to find that pupils are carrying such weapons, guys. But it's not a shock. You know, you go to Soshanguve, there are schools in Soshanguve where some of the students are carrying knives or carrying pangas. I mean, there was that one incident of the child who actually threatened a teacher with a panga.
It's very bad now.
And it just makes you question, Jorge, should the raidings now become so regular?
If not the raidings, then what? Because honestly, it's not just the lives of the students, the lives of the teachers. Now a teacher can't reprimand a kid.
Because
now you are teaching your mate, someone who thinks, you know what, we are equal and I can do whatever I like to you.
Someone who knows their rights.
And it's like, if you attack me, then I might as well just attack you.
Yeah.
And also, I feel very sad for the kids that are going to school to actually learn.
Because
now it's disturbance and it's frustration. You go to school, you're supposed to be safe in the premises. And then the learners are now doing this to each other.
And the thing is, it's become such a, like, it seems as if now it's sort of normalized that most of the schools in our country are so violent. But I must say, hey, at least we don't do shootouts like in USA. I must say that. Yeah. It's actually quite better than the shootouts that we hear in America. Mm. But it's still not as safe as we'd want them to be. Because as you're saying, the teachers, Vele, sometimes they actually do feel scared to not only reprimand the children, but tell them, no, what you're doing is wrong. Because at the end of the day, you'll have that one kid that decides to stand up to you. And now you can't do anything because gang, either the cell phones come in and they start taking a video. And next thing you know, you're trending on social media. Mm-hmm. And it's like a big problem. And my problem is that sometimes some of the schools that are actually most of the time problematic are near the official buildings.
It's always the case. It's always the case. The school is right there and the police station is right there. They're opposite to each other, but it seems like the police are like, oh, you know what? Kill each other, kids. You are doing us a favor. If you are dealing with each other like this, it means less job for us.
Exactly. And it doesn't make any sense because at the end of the day, we're supposed to be protecting these children. We're supposed to be caring for them. But you have schools in Eldorado Park. You have schools go West Berry that are not in a sense promoting gangsterism, but they're not doing anything to curb the fact. And you have parents who genuinely say, I'm scared for my kids who go to school here. And what can the parent do? You can't send the child to another district for the school because then that also is
that's another expense.
Exactly. It's another expense on top of the already expense that you're already having. But it's also worrisome because Juanos has to go to school. She has to go to school.
Like, I really feel like police should really invest in high schools. Because now we have these kids, they think they own the world. And I think another thing is that they know that the police are not doing their job.
Yeah.
And they also know that some of the police may or may not be part of the gangsterism that is in their neighborhood. So it's like, I know, you'll call the police, they'll raid the area, they take my panga. And then the following day, I'm going to come back to you.
With a panga. With another panga. And it's just like, it's like that. And it's, like I said, it's become something so that we've just normalized. Yes. I mean, now you have like a child apparently who's now charging people to protect him.
Imagine, here I am paying 50 rand for protection.
From other students, imagine. Not even from a whole gang, not even from a whole serious gang member, but from a student who's just coming up in the gang.
And also these old people from the streets, they should stop doing this to kids. They should stop making kids to sell drugs for them and join the gangsterism. No, all people need to come back and teach these kids rights. It's
not
wrong.
Not all of us have living ancestors, Nandi.
You know, but Gwena, they have a gang member, the owner of there. Why are they recruiting kids?
It's a new way, I guess. Now, I don't know. I'm not speaking for gangs. I'm just saying that's what I heard. But you know what? Speaking of hearing, guys, let's talk about IOL. Independent media. So they recently issued an apology after they had mistakenly identified the wrong person as the individual behind the controversial Gulam V account on Twitter, right? So they're saying, no, they incorrectly named Mohammed Yaqob Vada, a UK Z lecturer and a comedian, as the person behind the account. And let's just see, they posted an apology on their social media pages. Let's just listen to that clip of an apology.
Initially, our investigations identified two individuals linked to the Gulam MV Twitter account, both named Mohammed Vauda. However, during the press conference, a technical error occurred in that the wrong profile was shared with our content teams and the public. This error resulted in the incorrect identification of a UKZN lecturer and comedian being identified as the person behind the account. For this error, we unreservedly apologize to Mohammed Yaqob Vauda, who was mistakenly identified. As Chief Executive Officer of the IOL platform, I will be taking concrete steps to ensure that such an oversight does not occur again. Both independent media and IOL deeply regret the error. As responsible media outlets, we have taken the necessary steps to correct the information provided and published.
So a lot of people are just saying that, no, man, you apologize, but you don't really apologize at the same time. Not only did you choose to do a story on the account, but then you proceeded to hold also a media briefing to reveal the account. And then when you're corrected and told that, not only that, you only like realize that it's the wrong person when you're getting sued.
But wait, isn't journalism more about investigating the information that you receive before putting it out there? Because, I mean, our audience and the public relies on us with information. And they would automatically believe, we know IOL, like...
It's a big company, yes. You know, it's a big media company. So
if they tell us this, Jacob did this, we'll believe.
I mean, that's why the guy was getting, a lot of threats and like getting a lot of threatening messages. A lot of people were telling him to like go kill himself and stuff like that. So obviously I understand why he wanted to sue IOL. Yes. Because they didn't verify. My question is, did they go through the proper verification methods? So what, they got a tip. They got a tip that no, let's say Uhemen. Is the one that's behind Trump's killing. Trump's shooting. I'm so sorry. Uhemen is the one behind Trump's shooting. Did you confirm that Uhemen is behind it? Trump's shooting? Did you, what ways did you confirm that? I mean, it's basic. I think it's basic 101 ethical journalism.
Yes, it's that basic.
It's literally that basic. Check your facts. Is this the one? And how, and my thing is, how are you going to check whether or not there are people who, you know, are actually responsible for that. Okay. And the thing is, I don't know, can we ask the Twitter people if we can confirm the account. You know, confirm this account for us, if not. But at the end of the day, I think they should have taken proper measures to do it properly.
Yes.
Because now people are like, here we go again, another 10 Bisa 10.
Exactly.
Another 10 Bisa 10. And are we supposed to believe you going forward? Are we supposed to believe what you're saying going forward? And is it a thing, Yaore? Not only that, because I also think about defamation of character.
Yes,
guys.
That he could go to that extreme.
I mean, I would.
Yeah.
I definitely would. You ruined and you tarnished my name. Like, you made people come after me.
And you know, South Africa is not safe.
People, it's not.
We come straight after you. We.
It's not.
Yeah.
We know where you sleep, where you are. We can find you very quickly and very fast. I mean, they found that prison guy very quickly and very fast.
Yeah.
And they dealt with him. And now he's in maximum prison. So, like, I think, like, we should, as journalists, I think we should just be very careful about the information we put out. Then we should always make sure that it's the accurate information. Because we can actually, one article can actually ruin a person's life.
Nice.
It can definitely ruin a person's life. And I don't think sometimes we realize the power that we actually might have.
Yeah.
I think we take it for granted. A lot of the time. And I hope IOL learned their lesson. And, you know, going forward, they know what to do. So speaking of hopefully learning lessons, we have Cecile Kekana. You know, Cecile Kekana has been also making the waves on social media, on our platform. He murdered his partner, Dorcas, who had just actually made her biggest achievement in her career. So, like, she had... And, like, let me just let Herman explain to you who Dorcas is.
Okay. So this week, starting from Sunday, I was writing a story about a scientist who was killed at her maternal place in Johannesburg. So it seems like they had a fight at night on Wednesday evening. And then on Thursday, when the domestic worker was busy doing errands in the house, doing normal routines, she found Dorcas with stab wounds, and then she Silas Kekana, the husband, tried to kill himself by consuming overdose of medication. So fortunately or unfortunately, he made it, and he made his first appearance on Tuesday. So Dorcas is basically a scientist in South Africa, a young African girl who's trying to prove the connection between African medication and the normal one that we know. So she was trying to prove the link between these two things, to say they work effectively together. So there's no need to what's the word? To say maybe, you know, we Christians, or let me not say what's this religious, but you know, there are certain people, when you use African medication, they try to say you are trying to achieve something bad. So yeah, the story is that this young girl who was in the top 200 of young South Africans who are doing well, that was recorded by Mail and Guardian. She was murdered about two weeks later by someone who was supposed to love and protect her.
So today we are joined by a guest speaker from the Transform Education About Rape and Sexual Abuse Foundation, the Tears From Foundation, and we're joined by Michael Massina, a specialist wellness counselor from the foundation, to just speak to us about the continuous plague of GBV in the country. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So, Michael, just to jump right in, I'm sure you're familiar with the case here, Dorcas, and the story about Cecil Kekana. Can you just explain to us what exactly are the typical reasons? I mean, I think we all kind of know them, but just to brush up on the facts, the typical reasons for victims who consistently remain in abusive relationships.
Yes, no, of course. I am familiar with the story. We at Tears are very much devastated when we heard the news, and when the news came out, we tried to keep up with the media as well, just to find out how we can also better improve in assisting victims and survivors of GBV. To answer your question, the GBV as well as domestic abuse is definitely not one-dimensional in nature. In all of the cases that we've dealt with, I can safely say that there are a lot of similarities in terms of the fact that there is a victim that has obviously been deeply scorned, and you have a perpetrator that induces the violence. But each and every case is definitely subjective, and not one case has been exactly the same to the other. And some of the typical reasons, however, that we've seen why anyone would choose to stay in an abusive relationship, if I can mention just a few from the top of my head, the biggest one we normally notice is financial reasons or dependence on the perpetrator or the abuser. So you find that the victims, they are dependent on them. They stay with them. Most of the time, the perpetrator tries to make sure that the victim is not employed, or they do not work, so as to be able to make it easier for themselves to control them, right? And of course, if they do work, we've also seen instances where they're then in charge of all the finances. They even get to a point where they're the ones that are handling their cards and all their finances. So they make those decisions in terms of financial reasons, so as to say that the victim cannot even have a chance to maybe save up or put some money away for days when, you know, they also want to leave. Another reason that we've come to see is isolation. So what they do is they kind of make sure that during the course of their relationship, they try and make them end any form of relations with their trusted family and family members, so as to ensure once again that they can't leave, because then they have absolutely no one to turn to. The family and friends, those bridges have been burned throughout the course of their relationships. And the perpetrators are very smart in that. The idea and the tactic is most of the time very intentional in nature as well. Another one, of course, reason is also mostly common within women, I would say, that we've seen, is this idea or the belief that they can change the man, right? So they stay in the relationship out of the assumption and the hope that, okay, I am going to be the Bob the Builder in this relationship. I can fix him, or he's not like this. Going to get better. He's going to change. So I just need to stay and hold on longer to the relationship, and he's going to become a better person.
Okay. Thank you, Michael, for your time. I just wanted to ask you two questions. One, firstly, I just want to know, how hard is it to leave an abusive relationship? Because as I was speaking to the family, I was told that she has been planning to leave the marriage. And then secondly, How often do you come across with cases whereby you are told that at some point the family intervened and then the case was dropped and family influence basically? How often do you come across that?
We do come across those cases quite often, actually. But to just answer your first question, it takes the victim of abuse about 7 attempts before they can successfully be able to leave the abusive relationship. That is one thing we've come to realize. Normally they'll say and call in and say, I'm ready to leave. Can you assist me? And we'll start and formulate an exit strategy for them. But unfortunately, before we can even get to a point where we have safely removed them out of the instance, they will go back, because normally the perpetrator, this is somebody that they have come to know and live with for such a long time, and they know them very well. They know what tactics and manipulation ways to use in order to get the victim back into their house, right? So that is what normally happens. About 7 times it takes that. And in terms of family intervention, that's also another reason we've seen. You will try and assist, and then the victim will get, when you're following up, they get back to you and they say, no, actually, we decided to sit down as a family. We called in the uncles or the elders and we talked about it as a family, and we're okay now. We are going to be moving forward. But in doing so, what people really need to understand is the fact that there are certain things that can be solved as a family. There's certain problems, even marital issues, that can be solved by having a sit-down conversation and involving the elders. But when it comes to GBV and abuse, there is no such thing. That is one thing that you can't solve abuse. As soon as anybody is abusive, there is no way of saying we are sitting down and we're talking about it as a family. So the victims definitely do not understand that fault, and to a point where they even go and withdraw the case, as we've seen in the case as well at hand with Didi's case, because she did open a case previously, or in 2022. There was a case that was opened, but then it was reported that it was also withdrawn, right? Because they decided to solve matters as a family. But I can safely say that when it comes to GBV, there's never been a successful intervention that has been made by just simply sitting down and sorting things out as a family. The best way is to keep the case open and to let the justice and the law play its course.
Nani, do you have a question for Michael for us?
Well, I don't think it's a question for that sense, but in terms of Didi has made it in life, and we know that some women are powerhouses. And then can you just highlight also in terms of those women that we see on the outside appearance as being powerhouses, but inside the household, like their husbands are abusing them, and for them to speak to other people or their friends, they may feel as though their marriage is not perfect, and maybe question also, what is it that they are doing, more especially the family? Are you driving the husband or your partner into abusing you, or the part of the ego in men? Like, because I'd like to believe that, yes, Cecil did this and that, but some part of it, he was driven by ego, because Didi had made it in life.
Yeah, so of course you can find that a lot of perpetrators do get intimidated by successful women, not just perpetrators, but men in general. And that plays a role also in exactly what you're saying. It's not the causation for abuse, I can say that, but it definitely also is a factor, because Didi was successful and she had something for herself to show. She wasn't just sitting at home helpless or looking after children. That could have been a factor that may have also played a role in Cecil's abuse, but it is definitely not the primary leading factor for him being the perpetrator of abuse and getting to a point where he obviously stabbed him 6 times. What I can also add to that is, even though you find women that seem to have been fully functioning human beings, or rather have something and a sense of autonomy and are employed and are successful out there, but what you also need to realize is, at home, they might have gotten to a point of what we call in psychology learned helplessness. So what that means is that what abuse does to you is your self-esteem becomes so battered and bruised that you can't even imagine a life outside of your perpetrator. So that's what the perpetrators do. So she, in the same sense that the perpetrators do not, you can't spot the fact that they are an abuser, right? Because like we said with Kekana, the family mentioned that he was very charismatic every time they met up with him, and they could never imagine that he could be a monster behind closed doors. It's the same thing with the victims. They also get to a point where either they feel shame or they want to protect their social status as well as their public perception as well. The whole thing of abantu bazothini as well is also a thing that we've seen plays a role. So they try and protect that, and by doing though, keeping everything that's happening in their household a secret.
Yeah. Just from my side, what common trends or warning signs can a person see? Like, let's say in terms of Didi's case, how can I as a relative actually see or pick up that Didi is not okay and there's something going on and she might be going through a certain case of GBV?
Yeah, so it's not always easy being identifying those common warning signs, because like I said, the victims themselves actually go through extreme lengths to hide what is actually happening to them. And that once again goes back to the fact a lot of other issues, that the ones that I just raised. But a common thing that you can look out for is an over-controlling partner. That is normally one of the biggest things or telling signs. It's one thing caring for your partner and wanting to know if they're safe or they're okay, asking them, did you get home safe? But if you're hanging out with a Didi and you can tell that she's always anxious or she's always uneasy about the fact that, okay, fine, I'm out, or the partner constantly is calling, where are you? What are you doing? When are you coming back? All of those things then tend to now, it's a pattern, and it's a matter of, it's no longer just caring for your partner, but it's being over controlling. So that's one of the warning signs that anybody who is close to the victim can look out for. Another one is the isolation part that I've seen. So if you see somebody that they don't have a life outside of their relationship anymore, their life, they just live in this bubble where it's themselves as well as their partner, you can also look out for that as well. And of course, the physical signs themselves, any cuts, any bruises. So you need to pay close attention to the people around you as well. It's not easy to spot because, like I say, they hide them so well. It can seem like the perfect partner to the public. So those are just some of the things you can try as a colleague or as a community member or as a family, a friend, to look out for. But it is certainly not easy to spot.
Michael, I'm not sure. I want to just steer you off the case of Udidi just too. I'm not sure if you would be able to also assist in this one with the elderly abuse that we're constantly seeing on social medias. So I'm not sure how far either foundation actually touches on such cases. But I just wanted to get your understanding in terms of why they're also maybe not getting reported. Is it the same thing of as shame and isolation and only the family being able to deal with it?
In terms of why the cases are not being reported is what you're asking, sorry.
Yes.
No, there's also a lot of reasons. One, it's a matter of, we've seen that there's not a lot of trust in terms of our legal practitioners or police officers. Victims do not have trust because they've heard the stories. We've all heard the stories where somebody goes and tries to report a case at a police station and they're either not treated with the sensitivity that the issue of domestic abuse or GBV deserves. You find somebody there that has a stack of case files and they just make it seem like your case is just another one that's going to the back burner. So that's one of the reasons why then the victims are like, you know what, it's okay, I'll just get the counseling, or I'll just let it be, or I'll just withdraw the case. Because we fight with investigating officers almost on a daily basis. That's one thing that we also do on behalf of victims. We are the ones that actually have to pick up the call every day and be like, I have a case number, my victim reported on this day, but still now nothing has happened or come of their case. You haven't gone to take their statements. You haven't done anything on the case. So there's definitely a lot of improvements that can be done in terms of our police officials when it comes to victims reporting cases. And the the trust or the lack of trust is one of the reasons why so many cases go unreported. And also, in addition to the fact that, like I said, they also don't want it to get to that point where now their business is out there and everybody knows what's happening to them or what's happening in their relationship.
Just a reminder, guys, the husband is an alleged perpetrator. He has not yet been convicted or stood trial. So we just wanted to just make that disclaimer in there. Now, thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today and just giving us a brief understanding of what we actually are constantly seeing in the world. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day, Michael.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as well.
And that's all for this week's news wrap, guys. Remember that you can find our latest podcast review and subscribe for free on Ionu FM, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. You can also find us or follow us on all our social media platforms at Sowetan Live. This podcast is a Times Live production and our producer is Demi Buzo. Don't forget, you can also have a listen to our other podcast, Sunday Times Politics Weekly, Taking the Rams by the Horns, Business Day Spotlight, Gogo Have I Been Scammed, and 30 Years of Democracy. Thank you for tuning in. Join us again next week for more updates on the biggest stories from me, Gwena, and my colleagues, Nandi and Herman, and it's a wrap.